Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Anybody not read the book? Does everybody know what the book is? Would you like me to give you a synopsis? Because I realise that some people just like to join the discussion, but perhaps haven't had a chance to read the book. So maybe I'll do that first. So this month's book was Hunger by Roxane Gay, and she calls it a memoir of her body. Her body being that of a larger woman, a larger black queer woman. And she describes her relationship with her body largely after a serious sexual assault. It was a rape by a group of boys when she was a child. So that's the context of the discussion. So if everyone is forewarned, if that's the context of the book. And the reason that I chose it is because of two factors. One is partly around the discussion that we have in the social sphere and in general on the news and media about larger bodies, and the idea that obesity is a problem that needs to be solved and people just need to try harder. And what we see actually clinically is this relationship between trauma of several kinds, but the relationship between trauma and eating problems. And also something that I don't think gets discussed enough, which is sexual trauma in people's lives, in children's lives, and the long-term effects of that. So I don't tend to give trigger warnings because the evidence suggests that they aren't very helpful and they do more harm than good, but I want to make people aware of the context of the conversation if you haven't read the book. So just be aware that those are the things that we're going to be talking about. All right. So that said, did anybody have, I had a couple of people say that they found the book very moving. Did anybody have any other observations that they wanted to make about the book choice? Any thoughts that you have, I'm happy to hear. Otherwise, I will kind of get on with my observations. Yeah. All right. I'll get started and then we'll see where we get to. So when I pitched out to you guys, because I a little while ago I said, which books would you like us to do? And actually a lot of books came up, a lot of questions and requests came up around trauma, and which is why we did The Body Keeps a Score, because really there was quite an interest from you guys around understanding more about trauma. And I think that's really important because we can talk very generally about mental health, and we can talk very euphemistically about self-care and looking after oneself, but we don't find it very easy to talk about the reasons why people might be struggling with their mental health. We don't find it very easy to talk about really the harms that happen to us early in our lives that might make us more vulnerable to things later on. And I think especially with sexual trauma, childhood sexual abuse, I think it's so impossible for people to think about that they just don't, it's like brains get shut down, thinking gets shut down, people would rather look away from it. And what that does actually is to increase the vulnerability, because if adults can't bear to think about something happening, then they won't be able to protect their children adequately. But if survivors see that no one is willing to hear or to talk about or think about the experiences that they've been through, then they are just consumed often with shame, with guilt, with a sense of responsibility for what happened to them. And it makes it even harder for people to reach out for the help that they deserve. And that's the reason that, even though I know this is a difficult topic for people to be talking about, to be thinking about, it's not normal Instagram conversation. I felt a responsibility, I think, as a psychologist, as someone here with an audience. And if we're thinking about childhood sexual abuse, then we know that the NSPCC statistics suggest that 1 in 4 children experience childhood sexual abuse. And that's probably an underestimate because it's so unspeakable, and because boys and men tend not to talk about it at all. So it's something that's actually endemic in society. It's happening a lot. So I think it's really important for someone who has an audience, and I think a responsibility as a professional, to be able to create a platform or a space where we can have these conversations. So I wanted to do that. Go back to one of your questions. I love how complicated the topic was. When you see trauma in a film, there was always a clear resolution, and it showed the ongoing trauma. So in the book, I think what's so searing about Roxanne's or Miss Gay's description is how messy it is, you know, and I think you're absolutely right. She doesn't say, oh, well, then, you know, I got some therapy and now I'm in this fantastic relationship and everything is fine. You know, I lost some weight and everything is great. What she says is that, quite honestly, something was taken from her, and she spent a long time trying to reclaim that, to find it, to bring it back, to find her way back to herself. And that for her has been a lifelong, and you know, she says she's in a much better place. By the end of the book, she's in a much better place, but it's a lifelong endeavor for her, and she continues to work through it. And what was really striking was the way in which she was very, very clear to state and to explain that she had a very loving family. Parents were perhaps a little bit strict, you know, had expectations about academic performance, but that they were loving, and she knew she was loved by her parents, by her family. And yet she was still unable to find the words to be able to go to her parents after this thing had happened to her and say, you know, this is what's happened and I'm in pain and I need help. And that's kind of the reason, again, that I wanted to talk about this, is because that's partly the stigma around sexual assault, childhood sexual abuse, that there's something wrong with the victim, that the victim is the problem, and therefore it's something, a shame that they have to carry themselves. And I suppose I want to say very clearly now that that's not true. If anybody's out there who's been through this experience, that's absolutely not the case. And you were the child and they were the adult and you were exploited. So I think even in adulthood, people can wrestle with that reality. And partly what happens after people experience abuse in childhood is that there's an attempt to try to reconcile and make sense of it. This is a very confusing experience, a very traumatic experience. It can overwhelm the resources, the psychological resources of the child. And so there can be an attempt to try to wrestle back some power, wrestle back some control over something which was completely uncontrollable. Sometimes what happens is, and sometimes this is fostered by the abuser, the abuser will say that the child was partly responsible in some way, but the child will take on that responsibility. Maybe it was something I did, maybe it was something I said, maybe it was because I was bad, maybe it was because I was good, you know, that there was something that I had done to make this happen, or to mean that I kind of laid the foundations for it to happen. And again, I just want to make that clear that that's not true. You were the child and you were exploited and they were the adult and they had a responsibility to care for you and protect you. But this is a thing that happens, that people are kind of drawn into silence around these sorts of issues. And we see that in the book, that Roxanne just takes her pain and almost kind of runs with it. She leaves her course, she runs across the country, and then enters into this partly abusive, partly protective relationship with food and her body. And that's one of the things that really gets me around this very oversimplified discussion that is had, and we're going to be having more of since Boris has decreed that the entire nation needs to go on a diet. We end up in this incredibly reductionist, unhelpful conversation around people just needing to lose weight. And if you've never been in that position of having a high body weight and attempting to lose weight, if you've never worked with someone who has, where you've never seen the struggle and the effort, then it becomes easy to say that these people just aren't trying hard enough. And I guess what I want to say is, whilst I'm not suggesting that everybody with a higher body weight has experienced trauma of this kind, or that anyone who has experienced trauma of this kind is going to have this kind of relationship with food in their body, we do know that there's a strong relationship between the two. And we know, for example, so I just had a kind of look through the literature, that in terms of bulimia nervosa, we know that one episode of sexual abuse in childhood increases a risk of bulimia by 2.5 times. And more than two episodes increases a risk by nearly 5 times. So we see that there is this kind of cumulative risk factor of a body-based trauma and one's likelihood. You know, again, it's not consequential, it's not definitely going to happen, but one's likelihood of having a difficult relationship with food and body. And that makes sense. And it makes sense for two important reasons. One being that we have an emotional relationship with food. And if you've been around my page for more than 10 minutes, you know that that's what I talk about a little bit, that we, as well as, you know, eating well and enjoying food, that we do have an emotional association with food. We use food in these non-nutritive ways. We use food to comfort. We use food to soothe. We use food to distract. We use food to connect ourselves with our grandma on a cold afternoon in her warm kitchen. So we have these emotional associations with food. I'm afraid you can't avoid those. They are built in. They start from your first feed when you're a tiny baby. But then the second part of that is that we also have, of course, an emotional relationship with body. And particularly when there has been a body-based trauma, we cannot help that to be so. And so I guess I would just caution anyone, and you know, this is not to be damning or critical, but to caution anyone who thinks it's very simple, or who thinks that they can look at someone walking down the street and just make a decision about why their body is the way that their body is, and that we need to have a lot more compassion, but we also need to be able to suspend our judgment, because you never know somebody's story.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
All right. And quick back, go to your questions. Is there things a parent can do to create an environment where a child is more likely to share? Yes. And I will talk about that. What's the research around comorbidity with BDD, body dysmorphic disorder, and sexual abuse? I haven't looked at the stats for that, but what we do see is that in lots of trials where they've spoken to women with what would be considered obesity or supermorbid obesity, 50% have reported childhood sexual abuse. And also emotional abuse in childhood is the other factor. So when they look at the split between men and women with disordered relationships with food and eating, it's sexual abuse and emotional abuse for women are the clear factors, the contributing factors. And for men, it's emotional abuse and physical neglect. So emotional abuse is this key factor in both men and women in this relationship between childhood adversity and adult difficulties. And it's not just, of course, feeding difficulties. We're focusing on feeding difficulties because that's the focus of the book, but other psychological concerns as well. So that's the context. And yeah, I guess this is going to be slightly less book club and more about kind of appraising these issues in the context of what Roxanne raises, unless you guys have any questions specifically about the book. But as we tend to use the book as an organizing theme to talk about some of these other issues, I did want to, whilst I had the audience and whilst I had you here, want to make some kind of clear points about what's important in creating an environment in which children can share, absolutely, but also in making sure that adults are doing what they can to protect children in the first place. So one of the first things that I would implore all adults to do, and this is adults with children, adults without children, adults who, I mean, teachers and things will already be well versed in this, but really anyone, is to believe what you see. And when I say that, what I mean is quite often we don't want to believe what we see, or we don't want to believe that something could be happening, and we'll want to, you know, turn a blind eye and wish it away. On a much bigger scale, we saw it with we see it in the Catholic Church, right? That stories were coming out, and even though there was this entire systematic cover-up, there were also, you know, well-meaning Catholics who just didn't want to believe it. We just didn't want to believe that this terrible thing was happening in their church with people that they trusted, with people perhaps who they'd had round for dinner. They just didn't want to believe it. And the very, very first thing that any child will need from you is an adult who has the capacity to believe what they see. Yeah. So, and I think that's tough because these are unthinkable things, you know, and I say that, and I mean that very seriously. These are unthinkable things. Nobody wants to think about them. We want to live in a world where these things don't happen and children are not at risk, but the statistics indicate that that's just simply not the case. And so it's really about being able to come to a point in your own mind that you can believe that bad things happen, or is basically what I'm saying. Can we believe that bad things happen? And if so, can bad things happen to people that you know, children that you know, children on your street, and at the hands of adults that you know, maybe adults that you've had a beer with, adults, you know. So it's really about having to have the wherewithal to tolerate the cognitive dissonance that comes up when you're faced with the possibility that either somebody I know has done something egregious and awful, or that this innocent child has gone through something awful. But the first step is being able to tolerate that thought in the first place.
Go back and make sure I'm getting everything.
Yeah, so Ali says her ability to tell the story with such raw, unfiltered language is amazing. And it's really startling how thin the book is, isn't it? And how short the chapters are. I think that's one of the things. How starkly she moves on. I listened to the audiobook because I thought it was really important to be able to hear her tell her story in her own words. And quite often, again, because these are unspeakable conversations, you'll see anonymized heads on news special editions or anonymous stories in anthologies or whatever. I felt it was really important to honour her by hearing her tell her story in her voice on the audio. And it's unflinching in the audio as well. You know, there's something about the importance, again, of being able to see it as real and not as kind of ethereal, something happening far away, but to be able to be contextualised in the reality. So no, I absolutely agree. This happened in my family and the parents didn't want to believe the child. Yes, so that's something that I'm going to come to. So The first thing is to be able to believe what you see. The second is, you know, and I think about this in lots of ways of mental health, but the second is to be preventative. And so one of the things that I suppose parents do it because they don't want to, I don't know, break a child's innocence, or they don't want to think about something terrible happening. So they just hope that it won't happen. But if you just hope that a terrible thing won't happen, it's like getting in a car and not putting on the seatbelt because you just hope that you won't ever get in the crash. You have to, you know, it's fine to hope that it won't happen, but you need to make sure you're doing everything you can to keep your family safe. And that starts with the importance of, I think, teaching children, boys and girls, bodily autonomy, right? And this is something I talk about a lot in terms of adults. You know, I'm always talking about what I call self-possession. You are in charge of your body. It's yours. No one has the right to tell you anything about your body, whatever shape, size it is, whatever condition it's in at the moment. It's self-possession. You own you. But we tend to only decide that that's relevant or important in adulthood. And we need to start thinking about it much earlier in terms of letting children know that no one has the right to touch them, you know, even if it's someone that they trust, even if it's someone that they know, even if it's a sibling, because quite often there is incestuous abuse by an older sibling that never gets spoken about. And again, parents never believe. So teaching children bodily autonomy. No one is allowed to touch you, even if it's somebody that they trust. I think in the NSPCC, they use, I think it's kind of basically the underwear areas to help in an age appropriate way to teach children what areas are theirs and are private and shouldn't be touched, looked at, talked about, and what's not appropriate. And then to let that child know that if anybody even suggests something like that, and I'll put the link into the NSPCC website where it goes through this, that they come and talk to you. And I think one of the big problems that come across in terms of disclosure of sexual abuse is parents who can't tolerate discussion about sexual matters, right? So that, again, even if it's not about an abusive situation, people who can't tolerate the idea of sex or, you know, dirtiness and dirty things find it very, very difficult to tolerate these kinds of conversations. And again, it's about creating an environment where a child can ask you questions, where they are taken seriously, where you are curious about what they have to say, and where you give their words value. So I think, you know, that's the setting. The big thing that I want to say, and it's kind of devastating that I have to say this, but if a child discloses abuse to you, please believe them. I cannot tell you this devastation that it does to someone's psyche for a child to have mustered the courage to perhaps, you know, talk back against an adult who they were frightened of, or someone that they trusted, or an older sibling. For a child to have found the courage to tell someone of what's happened to them, to then not be believed. You have to understand that it's a kind of shattering of that child's sense of trust in the world. And what I want to say is that people who've been abused aren't, I think there's a stereotype that people who've been abused are broken and damaged goods and they're lost forever. That's not the case at all. And again, if when we're talking about stats that say 1 in 3, 1 in 4, you'll have to assume that many of, if not you, then many of the people that you know will have experienced something like this, and they're not broken and damaged and incapable. But the difference between someone who discloses abuse and is believed and someone who discloses abuse and is not believed is extraordinary in my experience. Because what it says to that person, to that child, is that you're on your own. You're on your own, and perhaps that you distort their sense of reality. And that can be damage that takes a lot more work to undo and to reconcile. And I say this because I've heard now many stories of people who have disclosed stories and just been told, don't say that, it's not true, how could you say that, or you must have done it, you know, really shattering things. And so those are the three big things. Prepare children with bodily autonomy, making sure that they know that their body is their own. Creating an environment where you can discuss difficult things without it being shameful, without it having to be quieted down and put aside, and then believing a child. These, I think, are crucial foundations to, I think, changing the tide on a lot of the psychological distress that is endemic around our kind of general environment and community and society. So those would be my three things. Let's go back to your questions. Are there also psychological patterns of behaviour to look for in abusers? The stats are incredibly high that by the time someone is arrested, by the time a paedophile is arrested, they have usually abused hundreds of children. And so that's the other thing. If you hear of something, so there's this way in which often stories come out. Let's use R. Kelly as an example, right? People will say, oh, I knew he liked young girls, or I knew something was off about him. Like, people have this kind of back of mind sense that something's not right. You need to take that seriously. That what we need to be thinking about is that it's all of our responsibility to protect children. Yeah. And it's not, you're not being out of place by raising a concern, because if that concern is correct, then you've protected a child. And when you raise a concern, so either by talking to social services, a GP or the police, they will know how to properly investigate or raise the level of that concern to the appropriate place. So again, it's coming back to that original thing of believing what you see and not dismissing something, not diluting your responsibility and saying, well, someone else will deal with it. Because what you need to remember is that in all likelihood, we're thinking about a child in need of protection. And I think we all have a responsibility to do that. All right, let me just check where we are for time. All right, so in terms of engendering bodily autonomy, there were some things that I wanted to say. So use the right names for anatomy. Again, I think sometimes there's a worry about this because they sound too adult, the words sound too adult, but they're the biological names for things. And I think if you can't use them, it almost suggests that there's a shame to it, and that engenders a sense of shame about body that can end up leading people to stay quiet if and when something happens. So if you can use the right names for the body, then do. Just make it an everyday thing. Again, it's about making it something that we can talk about without being frightened, without, you know, blushing and going, ooh, it's your body. No one is allowed to touch them without their permission. That includes teachers, coaches, doctors, clergy, right? So you let them know that all of these people who in the rest of life, you know, children are taught to be polite and compliant and to do what an adult says. When it comes to their body, you need to let them know that that's where they have autonomy. Another note that I have made on behalf of almost anyone that I have ever worked with is never criticize or disparage your child's body to them or in front of them to others, right? So, and I've said this in my book, I think. I've got a whole section in my book, which when I sent it to my publisher, I said, I had to apologize. I was like, I'm sorry, this chapter's a little bit punchy, but it was written on behalf of anyone I've ever worked with. And they said, no, it's absolutely fine. We think it's really important. And I talk about not comparing your child in a negative way. You know, don't say, oh, couldn't you be as smart as your sister or as pretty as your cousin or as bright as the next door's kid? Like, never do that. Please never do that to your children. It doesn't help. It doesn't help motivate them. It just makes them see that you think other kids are better than they are. Like, please don't do that. And certainly don't do it about their bodies. Don't say, oh, you're a bit plump, or oh, you've got your mum's nose, when you've already said that you hate the mum's nose. Just do not disparage, because again, this is about building autonomy and helping someone feel that their body is their own. And you undermine that when you criticize a child's body or when you compare it to somebody else's. And again, this isn't to condemn if you've done this. I think it's a very common thing to do. People do it offhand. It's just to invite you from this point onwards to be much more mindful about it. Because, and again, you know, I potentially see a very skewed sample. I get that. And so perhaps the people that come to me are the ones who suffered worst from having their bodies disparaged by their parents. But I can't see a world in which it's good for anyone. So how about we just stop doing it? So that would be my next tip. And more broadly, because what it does, when you disparage their body, you compare it to somebody else's, or even if you're sitting down watching television and commenting on somebody else's body on the television, all that does is to contribute to self-objectification. What it does is to create an environment, or I mean, the environment's already there, but it reinforces an environment and a set of beliefs that bodies are there to be looked at. Bodies are there to be critiqued. Bodies are ornaments there to be dressed, shaped, and remolded, rather than bodies are part of your entire being. Bodies are you. Bodies are incredible and fantastic and capable of amazing things, deserving of respect, deserving of care, deserving of curiosity and awe. Like, you know, and what you want to be doing, what I would love for parents to be doing much more, is helping to engender a sense of awe and inspiration and affection for their bodies, rather than reinforcing something that is already present, which is the idea that bodies are things to be looked at, judged, critiqued, and reshaped. So I'm kind of laying down the law today, but yeah, I'm not apologizing for it. Also, and I'm half tempted to caveat this again by saying that I see a particular group of people, but again, I can't see a world in which this would ever be helpful. And the note that I've put to say is, don't put your child on a diet. I have never heard... I've been training and practicing therapy for 20 years. I've been in practice for 10 years independent. I have never heard a positive outcome from someone whose parent put them on a diet. If I'm wrong, I'm happy to be corrected. Maybe there are some outliers out there. Maybe there are some people who feel that it did them some good. I have never heard a story like that. I understand that parents want to protect their children, keep them healthy, look after them, keep them well. That is your responsibility, of course. I don't think a diet in terms of a calorie plan where you teach children how many calories are in foods and teach them that they need to exercise in order to lose weight is compatible with that. You know, by all means, change the way the family eats to make it more nutritious. You know, by all means, to start all of you going, you know, walking to school, you know, make these, if you're making changes, make them as a family. Please do not single your child out as having a problematic body. I've never seen a good outcome. It ends up hurting people, separating them from their bodies, making them feel like failures to their parents if they can't keep the weight off. And what that does is to set up these conditions of worth where people end up feeling that their parents would be happier with them if their bodies were different. So that their parents' love for them is conditional on the shape of their body. And I've seen this stated explicitly where people, several times, people have been paid by their parents not to eat. Please don't do that. Please. All right. So next on my list of things is to, as I say, to talk to children about sexual abuse, let them know about, and again, in an age appropriate way, I will put the links up, let them know, because the silence is where abuse breeds. Silence and shame and stigma is what are the conditions that it needs in order to continue. But talking about it in an age-appropriate way, empowering your children to say no to an adult when it comes to their body is so, so important. To me, it was the other way around. I was too skinny growing up, and my mother would always shame me for it. I guess we're talking about diets in the context of the book, but yes, any kind of shame around a child's body is going to separate them from a sense of ownership of themselves and from an opportunity to feel proud about their bodies and to consider themselves to be part of their body, if you know what I mean. So lots of us live in a world where we're very disembodied. So we kind of live in our heads, and then our bodies are just these kinds of things that carry our brains around, or carry our personalities around even, because I don't think people think about their brains very much. Whereas it's, if we can move, and this is a big ask, but if we can move much more to a state in which people consider themselves whole, integrated and autonomous, then I think we shift ourselves away, or just gently nudge ourselves away, excuse me, from a sense of the body as an ornament and the body as something to be reshaped and looked at. So what about teaching children healthier options for them to choose from? So, I mean, there are lots of discussions around what we mean by healthier, because I've worked with lots of people who have, when people hear healthy, they hear low calorie. And I think it's about helping children to understand, when we think about bodily autonomy, the very early things that you see when you're feeding children, when you're feeding babies, which is when they are full, you know, as soon as they feel satisfied, they will turn their heads away. And they know that's an automatic response. That is an automatic response that we all had at one point, but that we were socialized out of. So when we're told to clear our plates, when we're told, oh, go on, just finish that for me, when we're told that it would be good for you to have that, you know, all of these ways in which we're socialized out of listening to our bodies, listening to those innate cues in order to satisfy something from outside of ourselves, is part of that separation from what I call self-possession. And I think the skill, the art of the parent, is to supply a range of foods. And I mean, and this will be different, you know, if there are particular health risks, that's something to discuss with the GP, but supply a range of foods in a non-anxious way, and just supply those foods. Like, if you supply them, if you present them, if there's no anxiety around them, if you're not going, oh, I should resist those biscuits because they're naughty, your children will respond not so much to what you say, but from the example that you set for them. So it's, If you're thinking about food in these plus minus black white good bad ways, then that's what they're going to see. So often it's about the parent having a much more balanced approach to eating, a non-anxious approach to eating, and having kind of just normal boundaries around food. And I say, I guess, normal in inverted commas, because I think it becomes quite difficult, because very few people have a relaxed relationship with food. But if you can be as non-anxious around it as possible, that's really helpful. My mother constantly commented on my eating, and I had an eating disorder in my late teens. Maybe at some point, I was thinking about doing a podcast episode called Mothers and Their Fat Daughters, because I think there's a very particular toxic relationship that can emerge there. I'm not saying that you were a fat daughter, but I think there's something very particular about what happens is, very often, and much more than it happens with boys, is that women can see their daughters as an extension of themselves, and therefore that how their daughters eat and what their daughters' bodies look like feels like it impinges and reflects on them much more than it would what their son looks like or what their son eats. And what that can do is to really enmesh mothers and daughters in these very, very toxic relationships around what the daughter's body should look like, and then the daughter's attempt to try to satisfy her mother. So, okay. Let me have a think about that. This starts from such a young age. Even pediatricians ask if you're feeding your child. It's really tough. And I know it's really tough. And in a sense, you know, I'm talking in quite idealistic ways about us living in a utopia where we have bodily autonomy and everyone just eats until they're satisfied and then they stop. But if I can just, quite often what I'll say is that if we can conceptualize a world in which that's true, then we can start to play around at the boundaries of where those limits are in the real world and maybe move ourselves slightly towards, more towards something that would be a bit better for us. All right. Yeah. Yeah. So these dynamics get set up very early. I'm aware that we have strayed somewhat from the topic of the book. So my next couple of points, just so that you have them. And as I've said before, to not raise and this one's specific to girls because I think boys aren't raised in this way, but to not raise nice girls. And this is in particular because girls are raised to be quiet and nice and polite and compliant and to not be angry and to be helpful. And whilst I don't think that's a necessary component to being a victim of abuse, I think it contributes to a way in which girls then have a much bigger dilemma around breaking the rule of trusting an adult or telling on an adult, to be able then to disclose that abuse to somebody else. So, and I'm not saying raise horrible kids. Like, I'm not saying like teach them to smash windows, but take their thoughts seriously. If your daughter is angry, she's probably angry for a reason. I say this as a big fan of anger, and I have a podcast on anger, so you can listen to why I think it's fantastic. I've written about it in the book, that anger is your emotion of self-esteem. And the reason I say this is because anger is your indication that something is unfair or something is unjust, right? So if you are, the example I always give, if you're standing in a queue or if you're driving along and someone cuts in front of you or someone steps in front of you in the queue, you get this little burst of anger. And people often confuse anger and violence. They are different things. Anger is the emotion. Violence is a behavior that may or may not be associated with the experience of the emotion of anger, right? So you get this little flash of the emotion of anger, and what that's telling you is that something is unfair, something is wrong here, right? And so if you silence your anger, as women are often taught to do, if you silence your anger, what you are doing is silencing your signal that something is wrong, that you're being treated unfairly, or that someone else is being treated unfairly, right? Because we can get anger on we can become angry on behalf of other people. So if you cut yourself off from that signal, then you cut yourself off from recognizing when you're being treated unfairly, right? And that's when you are blocked from being able to advocate for yourself, right? If you don't even recognize that you're being treated badly, right? So let's say you've got a friend who always kind of takes the piss and is always making you pay for stuff, but you're like, well, I can't be angry with them because they're my friend. Then actually you never get to the point of saying, how about you pay for something? Or, you know, is this relationship particularly fair? So anger allows you to get to the point of saying, I deserve better than this, or that other person deserves better than this. And that is the foundation of self-esteem. I deserve better than this is an acknowledgement of self-esteem. It's an acknowledgement that you are owed more than the conditions that you're in. Yeah? So when I say don't raise nice girls, what I mean is don't castrate girls of their legitimate anger. Don't cut them off at the knees when they are legitimately angry about things, because their anger means something. And so if you can help your children to understand what their anger and what their emotions mean, then actually you empower them to A, understand themselves, but also B, to advocate for themselves, stand up for themselves, and that will help to keep them safe. Yeah. All right. So yeah, so under not raising nice girls, I said teach them to say no, teach them to value their minds and their opinions over their bodies. You know, value your body, but also value your mind, value your opinion. And I've said, I feel like I was maybe in quite a het up mood at this point. I've said teach them to fight, by which I mean maybe it's good for girls to know how to box or wrestle or to do judo, some sort of martial art, not because they need it to defend themselves, but so that they know how to harness their anger and how to focus their aggression. And also so that they can feel the power of their bodies. Because I think girls are often taught that the most attractive thing about them is to be fragile and delicate and light and as small as possible. But a girl who is into sports or, you know, knows how to fight is a girl who knows the joy of knowing her own power. I think that is a great gift to be able to give to a girl. And my final point was, do not disparage women's bodies. in general. So whether it's someone on TV, whether it's someone in magazines, hopefully, that I don't even know if they exist anymore. Those magazines where they used to just be a big circle around parts of women's bodies. Don't read those. It's not helping anyone. All it's doing is contributing to that sense in which a woman's body is there to be commented on, and that it's not her, right? Actually, in the same way that hopefully you wouldn't be circling people's faces and going, "Ha, come over here, look at that person's face." We shouldn't be doing that with people's bodies, because we are whole beings, we're whole people, we're not just brains on a meat suit. And to disparage a part of someone is to disparage all of them. And it would be really good if we didn't do that to each other. Life is hard enough. So just going to scroll back, because I'm aware we're rapidly running out of time. Teach children to have a sense of self and boundaries for themselves. Yes, exactly that. So if someone oversteps their boundaries, they can come to the parents or another adult. Absolutely. If you can say this about other people, but perhaps can't do it for yourself, are you still building self-esteem? Not really, because you're externalizing the value. So it's always about being able to do it for yourself. For me, and I think I said this in a previous book club. No, I said it in a previous video where I was talking about self-compassion. So there's a video on my grid. I'm wearing a pink jumper and I'm talking about self-compassion. And there's a little bit of comment and conversation underneath, because I've said, if you can show compassion for other people but not yourself, it's not complete, because actually what you end up is putting yourself at the bottom of the pile. And I think that erodes and undermines your own sense of self-esteem. So the skill and the art is to develop the capacity to give that thing that you find it easier to give to other people back to yourself. It's not good to tell children to stop crying in certain ways as teachers as express their emotions. I would agree. Or certainly the messaging we give around crying. You know, oh, don't cry. I'm like, cry. If you're sad, cry. It's important, because crying is a recognition of your emotional states. And what we want people to be able to do, particularly Brits, is to be able to recognize their emotional states. Anger is helping me recover from my ED. Anger for the lies in our society that I believe to change myself. Absolutely. Honestly, I feel like if more people could properly understand anger and harness it, we would actually be much, much healthier. I think I see a lot of sickness and a lot of illness because people are suppressing their legitimate anger. I haven't done it for book club, but I did read it and I would recommend it. Rage Becomes Her as a good book, which talks about the importance of anger. And again, the example that I always give is of Miss Rosa Parks when she refused to give up her seat on that bus in Alabama. She described feeling a blanket of anger cover her. But she wasn't violent, you know, she wasn't punching people. But she was there in her fury, and her fury was legitimate because she was being treated unfairly. She was being treated in an unjust way. And it was her anger, her capacity to harness her anger, which contributed to the civil rights movement and changed the lives of millions. So anger can be enormously positive if you can learn not to be frightened of it, if you can learn to understand it, if you can learn to harness it. And to bring us all the way back to the actual topic of the book, that we need to be much more compassionate in our appreciation of other people's bodies, irrespective of what size they are. Never make a judgment about why you think somebody looks the way they do. You have no idea. Our job as adults, whether we have children or not, is to protect children. They are the next generation, they are our future, and if we want healthy societies, what we need is healthy, protected children. And that starts by being adults who can believe what they see. Thank you. We are, I think, at time there. Thank you very much for your time this evening, for what I appreciate is a more difficult conversations than the ones we would usually have. I appreciate you sticking with it. I do think it's important. And as I said at the top, if this is something that has happened to you or you experienced, please remember that you were the child. It wasn't your fault. It's not your shame to carry. And I would encourage you, if you haven't yet, to find someone to talk to about it, because you do not deserve to hold on to this by yourself.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.